When you come now to listen to His Excellency Ojum Madukwe, who is High Commissioner to Canada from Nigeria, you'll be listening to 30 years of experience in politics and in service to Nigerian government and in later days in foreign service. Just to quickly go over, perhaps the most telling moment would be in 1983 when he was part of the National Assembly and later of the Constituent Assembly that produced the new constitution after the fall, thank God, of the Abacha regime. I mean, when I was in Nigeria, we had two military coups, and the great blessing is that Nigeria has moved on thanks to the work of the Constituent Assembly, thanks to the creation of the Constitution, and thanks to the vision of political leaders into the soldier boys staying where they should stay, in the barracks and on the polo field. His work after that in politics, he was chairman of the Social Democratic Party, advisor to a minister for foreign affairs. And then between 1999 and 2000, he was Nigeria's Minister of Culture and Tourism, and he had another portfolio after that, the Minister of Transport. From 2005 to 2007, he was the National Secretary of the PDP, followed by a period of another 3 years as Foreign Minister for Nigeria. And he's been the deputy director of Goodluck Jonathan's presidential campaign in 2011. Obviously a very successful one by definition. And now, of course, he's High Commissioner to Canada. We're looking forward very much to hearing from him. And I perhaps could say now that to the students, I think this is the great gift of McGill, that they can bring together on one platform two people like Professor Payden and the High Commissioner and a scholar like Joseph Mensah from Ghana. I mean, I think this is an embarras de richesse, vraiment.
Well, because I'm the son of a Presbyterian pastor, I always covet whatever looks like a pulpit at every opportunity. So I've sought permission of my colleagues to use this just for 5 minutes, because it looks like a pulpit, and right here in the famous McGill Chapel. Now, let me say quickly that I appreciate Dean Ellen and Dan and everybody else for this honor of inviting me to share some of my thoughts, and of course in response to Professor Padden's very brilliant presentation. And I wish to state up front, since he mentioned Biafra, that the redemption that followed the Civil War shows the infinite possibilities of the Nigerian state. So I fought in that war. I was a young Biafran officer. I was an undergraduate in the University of Nigeria, Nsukka, when the war erupted. And like any other able-bodied young man, I had no choice but to carry arms. This story is important because when the then French foreign minister, when I was foreign minister myself between 2007 to 2010, Ed Kouchner, who many of you remember was the founder of Medicine Sans Frontières, when I made an official visit on his invitation to France, and I asked him, how does he feel about his job as foreign minister? Because I knew he used to be health minister. He said, look, the most exciting time of his life was as a young doctor in a place called Ihiala in Biafra, in Nigeria. And he got so worked up talking about his experience in Ihiala. I think he forgot he was foreign minister. When he remembered that he was talking to the Nigerian foreign minister, he said, by the way, where were you during the Civil War? I said, I was a Biafran officer. The French foreign minister jumped up, hugged me, and said, welcome, fellow rebel. And of course, you could be sure on my Nigerian team, I had a strong team of people who were from the north that with whom we were, and from the west with whom we fought that, against whom we fought the war. And here was I, foreign minister of Nigeria, to speak about the country. As a young man, I bore arms to dismantle so that I can have my freedom in Biafra. So I told Ed Kushner something which I want to share with all of you here, that the most uncelebrated success story from Africa was how people who fought in that civil war, which was one of the bloodiest ever anywhere in the world, and the only reason why the international attention was not galvanized by it was because there was no CNN. The misery was terrible. The casualties were heavy on both sides for 4 years. Yet, without any external involvement, all sides came together, worked out a process of reconciliation that once saw the military out, because there will have been no civil war if you didn't have the military. The politicians will have known how to jaw, talk things out and resolve it. But once the military intervened in 66, matters started moving very fast down the abyss. Now the war was over. Those who fought on both sides now got together and went back into politics. I joined in politics at that time. Within less than 10 years, the civil war was over. The part of Nigeria that fought against the rest of Nigeria, that's the eastern Nigeria, the Biafran side, by normal political process, of course, with the support of our former antagonists from the north and the west, produced the number two citizen, who was vice president, who was a key spokesman of the Biafran effort, produced the Senate president as the number three citizen, and produced the number four citizen as the Speaker of the House. All these people came from the old eastern Nigeria, which constituted Biafra. Within less than 9 years, I don't know anywhere else in the world where that feat was achieved, not even the United States. Did you have that kind of record achievement in terms of accession to some of the highest offices in the land, short of being president? The point I'm making here was that, unfortunately for Nigeria, this resolution of the Nigerian crisis by politicians themselves was again interrupted by the coup d'etat of 1984 by a man whose name is General Muhammadu Buhari, who even right now is still one of the big voices in Nigeria, clamoring that he wants to be president under a civilian democratic regime. And because we are tolerant, we allow him to make that kind of claim. The point here I'm making is that no matter the challenges in Nigeria, we have the inherent capacity to resolve those crises, and that the final story is going to be a positive one. But that is not a Pollyanna kind of utopianism or hope I have. It's based on the fact that in spite of all the forces Professor Paddon has honestly mentioned that tend to pull us apart, the national elite fully recognized the fact that this is the largest black country in the world, 170 million people, and with resources that compare with any of the best anywhere in the world, is in our collective mutual interest to stick together. And that's why I wish to leave with these observations. That while we welcome the concern of the West on the issue of religious freedom, there's need for a nuanced approach. Because Nigeria is unique. No other country has the equal number of Muslims and Christians of that size. 70 million Christians and about 70 million Muslims. No other country in the world. Therefore, the response to the Nigerian situation, either in terms of religious crisis, or even religion-related terrorism act, has to be a unique response to a unique situation. It cannot be a case of one size fits all. And here, we may be looking at religious harmony as more relevant to what is the challenge in Nigeria than religious freedom. It doesn't in any way denigrate the importance of religious freedom. But with the complex mosaic Professor Paddin has talked about, that makes Nigeria one of the most complex countries in the world, mightn't the ethic or the rhetoric of religious harmony be more relevant, to not better in Nigeria than religious freedom? For somebody like me who comes from a Christian, Judo, Eurocentric kind of background, I won't have any problem understanding where you are coming from when you talk about religious freedom. But for those with a different background, for whom religion is the totality of everything, the state, the politics, and the culture, there might be some concern as to, is the West trying to push the concept of religious freedom as another tool of controlling a country that has perhaps the largest Muslim population in Africa? I believe that rather than your motives being suspect, let this initiative be more dialogue-driven than consequence-driven. Policymakers in Nigeria should not start getting nervous that when you push religious freedom, you are now going to come up with another list of how to say another developing country, maybe Nigeria this time, is being ticked on a list of the things is not doing well. It's being ticked on corruption, is not doing well. On security, is not doing well. On religious freedom, is not doing well. Because when that kind of paternalistic approach is sensed, then it could have unintended consequences. There's also the issue of not giving the impression that the West, which of course is suffering from a deluge of secularism, as distinct from secularity, the West is also having problems of non-belief. There is a lingering suspicion in non-Western countries that religious freedom may be a cover by Western countries to push its own culture of non-belief. And so if you are talking about the Judeo-Christian culture, you may be more credible if that Judeo-Christian culture, you are seen to really practice it in every sense of it. And I don't just mean in terms of the declining number of people who are going to churches in North America. No, there's something more about culture than just going to church. We're talking about, if one can go back to Niall Ferguson's great book on civilization, the six killer apps that made Western civilization so great, so impressive, so successful. Six killer apps: democracy, rule of law, competition, free market, and so on. These are concepts that even communist China are now beginning to emulate from you. Japan did that long ago and succeeded. And Japan is not of a Judeo-Christian society. In a Muslim country like Indonesia, Malaysia, have applied the Judeo-Christian concepts that made North America and Western Europe very successful. Therefore, you must guard that heritage by not in any way showing a less commitment to what made you succeed than will appear the case. Take the issue of rule of law. Of course, Canada has done very well there. Multiculturalism has done very well here. But we need to have your voices on the issue of rule of law, democracy, fairness, justice, more at the global level. How can we talk about rule of law in municipal jurisdictions and we don't have that we don't have democracy in the United Nations? Nigeria, for instance, is making an argument that how can issues concerning the whole world be discussed? Not a single African country is on the United Nations Security Council. The black world, the black community in the world is not represented on the United Nations Security Council. What is good for the goods is good for the gender. So there's need to have the Judeo-Christian heritage pushed at every level. Then you come across it to be more convincing. The last point I wish to make is that for us in Nigeria, the issue is not lack of religious freedom, because Section 10 of the Constitution makes it clear. And I had the privilege of being one of those who wrote this Constitution. It says the government of the federation or of a state shall not adopt any religion as state religion. The government of the federation or of a state shall not adopt any religion as state religion. So what we are going through is a capacity problem issue. And we would like to see countries like United States, Canada, Britain, and all our traditional partners work more closely with us in terms of building capacity, creating the necessary political, bureaucratic, administrative capacity that can make sure that we implement even our own laws. And of course, in doing that, the notion of freedom here should be looked at not only freedom from, but freedom for. Nigeria is a developmental state, and we can't afford your embrace of the apex of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You are comfortable, you are well-fed, you are rich. So you are looking at the apex of Maslow's hierarchy of needs of self-actualization, in which each time you are locating a new concept you want to be free from. For us in a developmental state, we are more concerned with freedom for, freedom to create the Nigerian state. It has not yet been adequately created. Freedom to confront poverty, freedom to educate our people, freedom to make sure there is no polio victim again in Nigeria. So your concept of freedom can complement our concept of freedom, and then we can work together with dignity and in solidarity. Finally, I do not subscribe to some of the notions going around in certain quarters that after 9/11, religion is the problem. If you look at some of the worst atrocities in the world, they came not from religion-driven ideologies. Nazism was not a religious movement. And I don't think the worst demonstration, manifestation of any religion, whether Islam or Christianity, whether in terms of radical Islam today or even the Christian crusade, can come anything close to the efficiency of what the Nazi war machine was able to do in terms of the Holocaust. Suicide bombers, it was not created by Islam. The kamikaze pilots of Japan, these were suicide bombers. Even the Tamil Tigers were also suicide bombers, and I'm not sure that it was purely religious. I have a feeling that religion has a greater capacity to correct the excesses of those who distort religion. And so a moving away from religion, which is to be fashionable in North America, which is to be fashionable in Western Europe, is not the solution. But I think there's need to embrace religion even more, to go back into what is it, say, in Judeo-Christian faith that made North America and Western Europe what it is. Ultimately, there are going to be two major religious tendencies as the world moves in the direction of preserving civilization and being a greater, a more successful planet. One is the life-affirming religion, and the other one is the life-denying religion. In all the faiths in the world, especially those faiths that tend to be very competitive, the three that came from Abraham, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, you have people who are life-affirming adherents, and you have those who are life-denying adherence. The thing is to cut across these various divides and create a global coalition of life-affirming adherence of the great historical religions and make the world a better and more secure place. There could be no better place than Nigeria to carry out that experiment, because we're right at the epicenter of the clash of two great civilizations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador, for that reflection on the balance between a sophisticated internationalism and the role of the nation state in solving problems today. And when you spoke about polio, it made me think immediately of the way Al-Azhar in Cairo had sent some of their scholars to Kano as an act of internationalism to talk to the imams there to make sure that polio, which nearly eradicated, didn't come back. And I think we all need to find the right sort of interventions, the right sort of sensitivity towards where a contribution can be made that's appropriate and one that is arrogant and all size fits all and the things that the ambassador is critiquing.